Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to Yvonne Brooks Show. And today we're going to do a show about how completely nutty and insane the world has gone. It's just, I was like doing my usual Google News scanning of the news, and story after story after story after story just were nuts. And so I figured, what the hell? Let's just do a review of how completely nutty, and this is just a partial review because this is just what I saw the last couple of days, maybe. So, you know, it's going to be fun. We start with a really fun story, right? Fun. This is so sad. So insane, so stupid. But at the end of the day, so sad because people are suffering, people are dying, people are. This is Venezuela in 2018. The inflation rate is going to hit for the year 1.37%. Let me say that again: 1.37%. I don't know what that even means, right? In January, the January estimates at the beginning of the year, the IMF made an estimate of what inflation in Venezuela was going to be, and they estimated it at the staggering rate of 13,000%, which is, again, hard to even comprehend what that means in terms of money, right? But now, it's 1.37 million percent. It's something on the order of Zimbabwe, maybe worse, maybe about the same, maybe similar, but this is Zimbabwe-like. I mean, what do you do? The paper's worthless, right? You have to start talking about trillions of whatever it is, the money they use in Venezuela. They're estimating that unless something changes, something is going to change. It has to change because at these rates, Venezuela just ceases to exist. Life in Venezuela just ceases to exist. They're estimated that in 2019, inflation will be 10 million percent. 10 million percent. Like, you can get 100%, prices have doubled, right? 1,000%, prices of what, right? 20x, right? 10,000%, 200x. 100,000, 2,000x, you know, just keep going. 20,000, you know, it's just nuts. It's just absolutely insane, right? And it's not like we don't know where inflation comes from. It's not like there's some people in Venezuela who, whoops, we didn't know this would happen. We did this by accident. We didn't know. We just thought we'd print money. I mean, we needed money, right? We need to feed ourselves. We need money to buy stuff, so we just printed it, and whoops, we got inflation. How did that happen? Like, this is a well-understood phenomenon. This is just people completely evading reality, delaying the end, delaying their death, living hell. Right? Somebody says online that post-war Hungary holds the record inflation of 42 trillion percent. Again, staggering numbers that lose all meaning at some point, right? What does it mean? Your prices double every day? I think it's more than that. Certainly at 42 trillion, they more than double every day. You'd have to figure that out. This is what happens when you have central planners who are losing control, who've lost control completely of the economy, who've lost control of the people, have lost control of everything, right? And all they can do at this point is sit and print money and keep printing faster and faster and faster money, hoping to appease the people so that they don't revolt against them and go hang them in the streets, which is what they should be doing to Maduro and his cronies. It is truly unbelievable. Life must be like that. I mean, I lived through 1,000% inflation a year in Israel in the early 80s, and it was bad. it was really bad. You got paid every week. You spent the money quickly because almost immediately when you got paid, it lost all its value. All wages were linked to inflation. So you made money you earned more money every week, but it was worthless. Here, linking wages, people must be making, people are billionaires, right? All over Venezuela. And yet they can't buy a loaf of bread and nobody will produce a loaf of bread and nobody will make any long-term investments. You can't make any long-term investment. You can't invest in anything because you don't know what its value is going to be. There's no way to price it. So zero investment going on. This is a country, as I'm sure you've heard many, many, many times, this is a country with the largest oil reserves in the world, larger than Saudi Arabia. Now, it's a slightly unfair comparison because in Saudi Arabia, it's really easy to get those reserves out of the ground because the oil is very shallow. In Venezuela, it's very expensive to get the oil out of the ground. But it's still true that they have more oil than Saudi Arabia. And yet, they're starving, zero investment in the oil sector, so they can't get any of that oil out of the ground. And they're running at 1.37% inflation. You know that they have lost control. You know that they are governed by insanity. All they're doing is trying to somehow stay in power and appease people. And of course, what happens when they print the money like that is, where does the money go? The money isn't distributed into the economy in any kind of equal way. It's not dropped by helicopters. It's not given to the poor. It's given to the cronies, primarily to the military, to keep the regime going. And that's what always happens when you get these hyperinflations. They go to the cronies. They go to the supporters of the dictator. They go to the people who are keeping the dictatorship alive. They're going primarily to the military, which is then probably converting them as fast as they can in the black market into dollars and stashing them in Swiss bank accounts or in Cayman Island bank accounts or in, you know, whatever bank accounts they can, right? In dollars or in gold. They're not stupid enough to keep their own currency. And of course, the regular people, the middle class and the poor are getting crushed. There is no middle class. The middle class is becoming poor. The poor is becoming poorer. And all in the name of an ideology that claims to care about the poor, all in the name of socialism, all in the name of reducing inequality in society, all in the name of redistributing wealth. Yes, redistributing wealth from everybody to the cronies, everybody to the powerful, everybody to those who have guns who control the economy. And people don't learn. And people don't learn, right? This is socialism. Just unbelievable. All right, so Venezuela, I mean, it's kind of beat that in terms of insanity, but here's one. It's not bad. It's pretty high up there on the insanity scale. Okay, so there's a former astronaut by the name of Scott Kelly, and Scott Kelly tweeted the other day, on Sunday actually, and he tweeted, one of the greatest leaders of modern times, Sir Winston Churchill, said, "In victory, magnanimity. I guess those days are over." That's the tweet. That seems pretty innocuous. One of the greatest leaders of modern times, Sir Winston Churchill, said, "In victory, magnanimity. I guess those days are over." Now, what do you think is bad about that tweet? Why would the internet explode over that tweet? Why would this astronaut, Scott Kelly, who is, the UN ambassador for space, another reason why there shouldn't be a UN. What the hell does a UN ambassador for space do? And who does he represent? Space? Aliens? Who does he represent? I don't know. So why do you think he had to withdraw the tweet? Why do you think he had to apologize for the tweet? What is wrong was saying what he just said? There's something unbelievably politically incorrect about that. Oh, good one. Bree is on top of this. This is good. Bree says Winston Churchill wasn't PC. Well, that's a nice way to say it. Winston Churchill was a frigging racist. What are you talking about? He triggered hundreds of replies from followers who blamed Churchill for the Bengal famine of 1943, compared him to Hitler. One tweet wrote, "Sir, with all due respect, Winston Churchill is just as good as Hitler." Another said, "With due respect, astronaut Kelly, Winston Churchill is not the greatest leader of the modern times, especially when he was responsible for the Bengal famine of 1943. Now many in the West perhaps know this. I would probably say he was one of the greatest orators of modern times." Churchill was... Now, I don't know much about the Bengal famine, and for all I know, maybe he was responsible for the Bengal famine, and maybe the Bengal famine was atrocious and bad. I'm sure Winston Churchill was not perfect. I know a lot of things Winston Churchill did which were not perfect. Among other things, Europe could have, the World War II could have been won much sooner. But politics delayed victory. Scott Kelly, but another, so I'm sure Churchill did a lot of stupid things. If you saw the series The Crown, there's some examples of Churchill not being perfect. He wasn't a laissez-faire capitalist. But he was a great leader, and he brought England through certainly one of its darkest hours, maybe its darkest hours. He probably prevented the defeat of Britain by the Nazis. And to say he was a great leader should be uncontroversial. It's not to say he didn't do bad things. It's not to say he was a perfect person. But here's what Scott Kelly tweets. I mean, this is, I guess, a day later. "Did not mean to offend by quoting Churchill. My apologies. I will go and educate myself further on his atrocities, racist views, which I do not support. My point was we need to come together as one nation. We are all Americans. That should transcend partisan politics." I mean, that's bullshit on so many different levels. Bullshit on so many different levels, right? First of all, Winston Churchill was a great leader. He won World War II. He rallied the British people to fight World War II. He truly... if you listen to his speeches, he wasn't just an orator. He was a magnificent orator in the cause of, in the end of the day, liberty. Not perfect liberty, not freedom as we know it, not laissez-faire capitalism. But he was faced with a foe, Nazi Germany foe. And yet, all people can think about is taking all of that context out. And to compare, even if he did cause a famine and bring about a famine, to compare him to Hitler, who slaughtered at least 12 million people, who engaged in a war that killed millions beyond that. It's just insanity, truly insanity. And yeah, it's good to have an objective appraisal of Churchill, and I'm sure he's nowhere near as good as he's certainly not just this great hero of World War II. He lived a long life. He did a lot of things. Some of them were pretty bad. He was a very mixed guy. There are definitely elements of collectivism in Churchill, and he was way too fond of colonialism, even when colonialism should have been passé. So it's bad on that point. And then we need to come together as one nation? What the hell does that mean? Who needs to come together? Me and Bernie Sanders? We need to go kumbaya, me and Bernie Sanders? Because after all, we're all Americans. The fact that he wants to destroy America, I shouldn't criticize him. I should be nice to him. I should be nice to the creeps who want to destroy this country. No. No. We shouldn't come together as one nation. Not without understanding what that nation represents. Not without understanding the ideas that represent that nation. There is an importance to coming together as one nation, because it's important that we all understand what America is. But as long as a significant number, these days, 80% of the left and 80% of, or 60% of the right, or maybe, I don't know, maybe everybody, have no clue what America is. I'm not going to come together with them. I'm not seeing kumbaya with Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump. We should transcend partisan politics. Yeah, partisan politics, I agree. We should transcend partisan politics. But we should be damn rigorous and damn furious and damn discriminating when it comes to ideas. When it comes to ideas. And those should transcend partisan politics. There are bad people on the left and there are bad people on the right. There are bad Republicans and there are bad Democrats. Because ideas are not exclusive to particular political parties. This reminds me, let me find this story. I have it here somewhere. I have it here. It's not that. There it is. All right, so here's the story. Here's an example. It links Venezuela with coming together as one nation. But note, before I get to coming together, note that the insanity of the political correctness. You know, you can't praise a great man because of his flaws, if his flaws have to do with race, or if his flaws have to do with colonialism, or any flaws. To compare Winston Churchill with Hitler is a travesty, or with Stalin for that matter, who really did starve probably 30 to 40 million Ukrainians in the post World War II era, or was it? I think it was post World War II, maybe pre World War II. Not sure. All right. So political correctness just run amok and it's just the insanity. All right. So here's the connection, right? So almost half, 48% of Democrats, of young Democrats, millennial Democrats, I guess millennials are what, 25 to 35, 25 to 40, I don't know, something like that. 48% of millennial Democrats said they would call themselves Democratic Socialists or Socialists. 48% said they would call themselves a Democratic Socialist or Socialist. This is in the face of 1.37 million percent inflation in the latest experiment in socialism. 48%. Only 39% said they would identify as neither. I guess the others didn't have an opinion. Right. This is socialism we're talking about. This is the system that's killed 100 to 200 million people around the world in the 20th century. This is the system that is killing people right now in Venezuela. This is the system that's brought 1.37 million percent inflation to the Venezuelan economy. And yet, 48% of millennial Democrats consider themselves democratic socialists or socialists. Now, I'll get to why that is in a second, but here's another staggering number to show you maybe there's not that much difference between left and right. All right. Among millennial Republicans, what percentage do you think consider themselves or would describe themselves democratic socialist or outright socialist? These are millennials that identify as Republican. You would think the number's close to zero. Zero, right? Republicans, they're against socialism. Even if they don't know what it is, they would at least know to say, I'm not a socialist. Well, it turns out 23% said they would call themselves a democratic socialist or a socialist. I mean, what does it even mean? Right? Now, good. 71% said they would call themselves neither. And we had six that weren't sure. 6% of Republican millennials are not sure whether they're a democratic socialist or a socialist or neither. These are millennials ages 22 and 37. 22 and 37. These are the people entering the workplace. These are the people who are getting to their productive prime years in the workplace. This is the future of America. And among Republicans, 23% consider themselves socialist, a democratic socialist. Now, this is why I'm not too alarmed. 48% of Democrats. I'm not too alarmed. Because these people have no clue what socialism or democratic socialism is. They don't know. They have no idea. And that's, in a sense, I mean, on the one hand, that's a good thing. At least they don't know, because if they knew and then they said this, that would be really scary. But most of them have no idea. Now, that's scary, because that tells us the educational system is teaching them no history, no economics, no knowledge of the world around us. They know nothing. Nothing. Some people are just discovering that they're millennials. Yes, you are a millennial. 22 to 37. Now, what do they think socialism is? They think socialism is Denmark. They think socialism is this cool place with lots of blonde people who bicycle to work even in the freezing cold. I never understood that. That seems like horrible. Really, really cold. They bicycle to work where, everything's clean. Everything is nice. Where, I don't know, taxes are really high, but it's easy to start a business. The government doesn't intervene too much. There's not a lot of regulations. And business environment is quite friendly. Not socialism, guys. A mixed economy, like the U.S. Slightly different mixture than the U.S. Not socialist. Denmark ain't socialist. As long as you want a mediocre life, as long as you're not overly ambitious, as long as you want a boring life, a simple life, and an ambitious life, as long as you don't want to get too rich, Denmark's an okay place to live. Food is fantastic, right? And it's pretty. It's pretty. So, anyway, unbelievable. Unbelievable. And let's see. Yeah, this is where we are, right? This is where we are. Socialism is now popular. Socialism now is sexy. Socialism now is anti-establishment. In other words, their vision of a mixed economy is now sexy. Bernie Sanders is sexy. Right? Oh, the other thing about Denmark, it's green, they think. They think it's green, right? Windmills and lots of solar energy in Denmark. Yeah, right. How often does the sun even shine in Denmark? Just craziness, craziness. Why anybody in the 21st century would call himself a socialist. I mean, socialism should be marginalized like neo-Nazis. There should be neo-socialists. That group over there, like skinheads who want to live in communes. Maybe they're not skinheads. Maybe they're the opposite. They have long hair and long beards, and they live in communes. They're the weirdos over there. They're the socialists. They're the equivalent of the neo-Nazis, the neo-socialists. But now, 48% of all millennial Democrats and 23% of all millennial Republicans would call themselves democratic socialists or socialists. Nuttiness. Nuttiness. I mean, the connection, all these stories, is really a complete and utter detachment from reality. Yeah, Ehud says, hello from socialist China. China's not socialist. There's nothing socialist about China. There's not a single communist in all of China. China is, if anything, is a authoritarian mixed economy, tilting towards fascism. Communism? Like, there's no welfare even in China. There's no socialized healthcare in China. Not really. I mean, all these terms, language, concepts, have lost all meaning. Do people actually understand what socialism is? No. Now, the thing is, I mean, Chris says socialists are just as evil as the KKK, and they are, absolutely. But the socialists are not just as evil. Because the KKK knows exactly what they represent. The KKK knows exactly who they are. Socialists, people who call themselves socialists, have no clue what they are. That's the scary part. Now, you can say they're evil because they're evading, more so than they're evil because they actually advocate for socialist policies, because most of them don't. Did these young socialists, the 23% of Republicans who consider themselves socialists, did they want the nationalization of the means of production? Even the Democrats want the nationalization of the means of production. Do they want Apple? under state control. No, none of them want that. None of them want that. Now, in the UK, there's a certain percentage that wants to re-nationalize the railways. But almost no socialists in America, I mean, these kind of socialists, these young socialists, these young, hip, cool socialists, actually know what socialism means, which means that the state owns the means of production. They have no clue about that. Right? Somebody's asking, what would you call South Africa? I don't know. I don't think South Africa is socialist. I think it's a mixed economy with heavy socialist elements. The state does not own the means of production in South Africa. In the sense that the state regulates the means of production in South Africa, then it's much more fascist than socialist. And I think most regimes in the world today, who most people think of in terms of socialism, I think are much more fascist in that sense. They're regimes that control the means of production rather than nationalizing. Now, South Africa could tilt towards socialism if, for example, it takes the land and it creates communal farms on the land, things like that. But none of these, I mean, socialism leads to Venezuela. To the extent that you see an economy that's not as bad as Venezuela, it's either heading in that direction if it's socialist or it's not socialist. And South Africa, we'll see. A lot's going to depend on the next few months on what they actually do with this land proposals. It's this idea of nationalizing all the land owned by whites, whether they do that without compensation, whether they do that or not, and so on. Right? Somebody says a friend who lives in Beijing told me private kindergarten costs $2,000 a month. That's not communism. It's not socialism, right? So I think we'll see. We'll see where South Africa goes. It's definitely tilting towards socialism. And again, remember what communism is. Communism is where all the means of production are owned by the state, where everything, it's totalitarian, not authoritarian, but totalitarian. And I don't think South Africa is totalitarian. You can still leave South Africa. You can travel in and out of South Africa. There are many things that still differentiate between South Africa and China and other countries and communism in the way it was practiced, in the way it has to be practiced. Thoughts on CT? I don't know. Who's CT? Tell me who CT is. I know who CT is. All right. Charles II. Thoughts on Charles II response to your comments today? I haven't listened to them. I don't intend to listen to him. I'm not interested. And, stop asking me about Charles II. I mean, you like Charles II? Listen to him. I mean, stop asking. What's the point? First, it makes this podcast objectivist only. And the reason I'm answering it is because it's a super chat question, so you put some money in it. I don't like these inside the ballpark, critiques. I said what I have to say about Charles II, and I said it reluctantly. And I have not listened to what he said about me. I haven't listened to what he said about me when he originally criticized me, which he's been criticizing me over and over again over the months, because I'm not that interested. And you guys, this is called independent thinking. Think for yourself. You like Charles II, you don't like Charles II, you like me, you don't like me. Support who you think based on your independent mind, based on your independent thinking, based on your independent research, based on your knowledge of the world and reality and facts and everything. Who you want to listen to and who's good and who's not. I'm not an authority. In that sense. And I don't want to get into giving a list of all the objectivist intellectuals, give them a grade. I mean, I'm not interested in that assignment at all. All right. So, yes, millennials, nuts. It tells you a lot about public education and private education Right. All right. What else? Where is my series of nutty things that are going on in the world? All right. Well, let's see. Yeah, here's one. Interesting timing for this announcement. We'll get to why it's interesting timing in a second. Exxon today announced that it is putting aside $1 million. Now, $1 million is not a huge amount, but it's symbolic. It's putting it, not $1 million is not a huge amount for Exxon. It's a lot of money for me. It's a lot of money for all of you. But for Exxon, not a huge amount. But they're putting $1 million aside over 2 years to promote a national tax on carbon. So they want to tax carbon use. And the idea is that you would have a dollar amount per ton of carbon released into the atmosphere that manufacturers, utility companies, and would pay. I don't think that you would have to pay it for breathing. You know, every time you breathe out, you're emitting carbon. But here we go. I mean, where's Alex Epstein? Alex, this is what you're supposed to prevent Exxon doing this. I'm sure Alex is freaking out in the background and is upset at Exxon and have just provided them with the right tools to think about it. And they have ignored him and they have resisted rational ideas. Again, the theme today is the insanity caused by evasion of the fact, by evasion of reality, by evasion of the benefits of carbon fuels. And here, $1 million over 2 years to have a carbon tax. Now, they want a particular type of carbon tax, which will appeal to Republicans. So it says the initiative's goal is to discourage companies from emitting carbon through the tax while minimizing additional cost to consumers. So what do we do with all the money that government is going to raise from this carbon tax? Well, funds raised by the tax would be channeled to Americans through what the group called a carbon dividend. How does that work? That it estimates could be as much as $2,000 annually per family. But we don't all use carbon the same, so we wouldn't all be paying the tax the same. So it's really just another mechanism to redistribute wealth from those who use carbon a lot to those who use carbon a little. I guess that's the way it would happen. So customers pay the taxes because of the high cost, and then they get the money. So how is this supposed to reduce the use of carbon? Let's think about this. So I pay higher cost for electricity, so I'm supposed to use less electricity, but then I get $2,000, which encourages me to use more electricity again because now I'm richer, so I can afford more electricity. I'm not sure if the scheme will work. Monthly payments would go directly to recipients. The tax would be revenue neutral. Now, why you would want a revenue neutral tax? This just increases government spending by whatever the tax is when we're running such huge and massive deficits. So if you're going to impose the tax, then use it to cut the deficit at least. But no, we're going to bribe consumers to love the carbon tax. And the reason they're doing this is because they think that, you know, Republicans are going to go for it. Exxon's contribution will go to Americans for Carbon Dividends. Americans for Carbon Dividends. Notice that the group is not called Americans for Taxes. Americans for Carbon Dividends. A new group. One whose co-chairman is, drum roll please. I need some sound effects. Drum roll please. His co-chairman is former Senate Majority Leader, a Republican. Oh, my God. How can a Republican be for this? Trent Lott. It is promoting a carbon tax plus dividend policy, first proposed by two former U.S. Secretaries of State. Drum roll, please. The Republicans, James Baker III and George Shultz. All three men are Republicans. Well, maybe we should. Maybe those 23% of millennials who are Republicans are right. They're right. The Republican Party is a socialist party. So it's okay to be a Republican and a socialist. The world is going nuts. So anyway, Exxon is trying to get other oil companies to join them, and of course, they're appealing to the Republican majority. And here we go. It's going to be great. And of course, you know what the largest source of reduction in carbon emissions in the United States has been? What is carbon emissions in the United States have gone down? Have gone down over the last few years. Anybody know what? Why have carbon emissions gone down in the U.S.? Is it solar? Maybe wind power. Nuclear? No, it can't be nuclear because we're not building any. We're decreasing our reliance on nuclear. The only actual solution if you want to reduce carbon is invest in nuclear. Forget carbon tax. Forget all that. Just invest in nuclear. Just replace all these power plants with nuclear power plants, and you would reduce the emissions by a huge amount. But no, God forbid. God forbid we actually do it. Yeah, Jennifer, perfect. Natural gas. Fracking. Fracking has done it. Fracking has caused a dramatic reduction in not sharing economy. Come on, the sharing economy is like a fraction of a fraction of a fraction. It hasn't reduced driving by that much. No, it's natural gas. It's fracking. Fracking has actually reduced the amount of emissions. Fracking of natural gas, which has lowered the price of natural gas dramatically. And natural gas emits far less carbon than any other carbon-based fuel. And as a consequence, the amount of carbon being emitted is negative. By the way, nobody ever calculates, and we'll get to this in a second, nobody ever calculates the benefits of carbon in the atmosphere, like the greening of the world. The world is far, far greener today. There's far, far more plants in the world today, far more plants in the world today than they were in the past, and as a consequence of the increased carbon in the atmosphere. And all kinds of benefits that come from having more plants. All right, so I did want to mention why this was news today, that's Exxon news today, because of the Nobel Prize in Economics. Yeah, what's the two? Why are the two connected? Well, we had two American economists win the Nobel Prize for Economics. I think it was yesterday. Professor Nordhaus, and Professor Roma. Roma and Nordhaus both won the Nobel Prize. They'll each get, I think, $1 million from the Swedish Nobel Committee, and everybody's been praising them to the hilt I particularly found this one article in the Wall Street Journal by David Henderson. Now, I don't know if you know who David Henderson is, but David Henderson is a well-known free market economist who teaches at the Graduate Naval Academy in Monterey. I know David, and David is a bit of an Ayn Rand fan, and he is a decent, good economist, right? But he always writes the commentary for the Wall Street Journal about the Nobel Prize winners, and he always tries to bring out the positive and not criticize them at all because they won the Nobel Prize. So they're there to bring out the positives. So what's this got to do with the carbon tax? Well, the carbon tax is a proposal that has been, I don't think he initiated this, but he has been a huge proponent of William Nordhaus, the now Nobel Prize winner in economics for this year. He won the prize for his economics of climate change. Basically, what he's done is built these massive economic models that predict the impact of climate change. Let's say temperatures go up by X, and let's say there's a cost associated with the temperatures going up because you have to invest, because now the climate's doing all kinds of things, you have to invest all kinds of money to not flood Florida, the climate is causing all kinds of damage and all kinds of wacky things. So you have to make investments, right? So there's a cost to climate change. So you model that. What's the cost going to be over the next 100 years of climate change? And then he asked the question, if we had a carbon tax and we modeled the impacts of a carbon tax on the economy, How would that impact the economy long term? And he's built these very sophisticated economic models that try to make these kind of predictions. And he has become a huge advocate for the carbon tax as a consequence. Now, we'll get to that in a second, because if you actually follow the models, you wouldn't be. But anyway, we'll get to that. What's interesting is that, you know, one of my critiques of the climate change models, and I'm not an expert on this, so I don't have a strong position about whether climate change is happening or not, caused by CO2 or not. I'm not going to get into that debate. But one of my critiques, and one of the critiques that is offered out there all the time, is of the models. The models are not very good. The models don't predict. The models have been wrong so many times. The models are trying to take a very, very complex environment and try to build it into a mathematical equation. And it's very, very, very hard. We don't know enough to actually predict the future climate, to predict changes in the climate, and therefore the models are bad because of all that. Now, if that is true about the climate, and it is, I think, true about the climate, we do not understand climate science enough yet to truly model these things out and make accurate predictions about the future. Hell, we don't even know what the weather is going to be like next year, but somehow we can model this out over 100 years and tell exactly what the temperature rise will be in the future. Yeah, Jonathan Horney points out that the models in the 70s predicted an ice age in the 90s. That didn't turn out right. Those were headlines, by the way, in the New York Times in the 1970s. The ice age is coming. If you think that's hard in terms of climate, and it is really hard, even the climate change people will admit that it's really, really hard. It is like 1,000 times harder when it comes to economics. It is really, really, really hard in economics. Because in economics, you have factors that you can't take into account. For example, the discovery of new technologies, the innovation of the human mind, the role of reason, the fact that if you tax something, what happens not only to the consumption of that thing, but how does that filter through the entire economy, and how does that affect innovation? And what about new discoveries? What about discoveries of technology to suck CO2 out of the atmosphere or whatever? You can't model that. What about human choices? I mean, economics is the science of human choices, or one of the things it does is studies human choices in the marketplace. The choices of producers, the choices of consumers, the choices of who to trade, under what price, under what conditions. Choices. How do you model choices mathematically? How do you put an equation together and therefore model what's going to happen with any kind of accuracy? Well, you can't. I mean, models are fine. They give us an approximation of stuff. They tell us kind of things that are interesting. I don't know if I told you the story of my first macroeconomic class that I took. The only economics class I ever took in an economics department. I got a PhD in finance. And I had to take two economics classes, a macro and a micro. And I think it was the macro class. And I walked into the first class in macro, and the professor put a differential equation on the board. Probably a differential equation created by one of these Nobel Prize winners. And he said, the entire course, we're going to derive stuff from this equation. Really? And that's going to explain the economy? Well, maybe it was microeconomics and it was a production function. But either way, it was stupid. And the rest of the class, all we did was differential equation, do revision from one differential equation. And it was dumb, and it was not economics. And I went to my advisor, and I said, I'm never taking another economics class in my life. You find a way to get me a PhD in finance without taking economic classes from these idiots, from these losers, because I'm not learning anything there. It's a complete waste of time. We did an independent study instead. Anyway, these are the kind of models that now Nordhaus and Roma devised. Now, what is interesting? Let's see. Nordhaus did a few interesting things. This is where in the Wall Street Journal, my friend David Henderson is trying to bring out some positives. So one interesting thing, and this is truly interesting, and this is fascinating actually. So listen to this. Pay attention to the numbers. The numbers are important here. The price of light. So Nordhaus calculated how much the price of light, of lighting, to read, to light your house, has dropped over the last 200 years. And he has shown that the price of light in 1992, adjusted for inflation, so taking out inflation, was less than 0.1% of the price of light in 1800. So notice that. That even when you adjust, for inflation, the price of light in 1992 is 0.1% of what it was in 1800. So if the price of light, let's say, was a dollar in 1800, then the price of light in 1992 would be 10 cents. Now, you can't capture that in inflation numbers. You can't capture that in aggregate numbers that the government produces. That addition to the quality of life, that addition to the standard of living, cannot be captured numerically. And as a consequence, all our inflation numbers are exaggerated. All our inflation numbers are exaggerated because they can't take into account the fact that while a computer today costs the same as a computer did 20 years ago, so inflation in the basket is zero for that good, the computer today is so much better, like 1,000 times better, 1,000,000 times better. How do you capture that? We don't. And therefore, when people say standard of living in the United States have not increased in the last 30 years, 40 years, which is a favorite line of the left these days, and of Trump supporters. I mean, I shouldn't have to say that, right? Trump supporters are on the left. I mean, the real supporters, not the people who voted for him. That's just not true. We didn't have an iPhone 30 years ago. And everybody has an iPhone. Everybody can afford an iPhone, the equivalent of an iPhone, a smartphone. How do you measure that? How do you measure that in standard of living and economic growth? It doesn't get captured. And that's why aggregate numbers, aggregate economic numbers are often meaningless in terms of really giving us a picture of the quality of life, of the true increase in the standard of living. And certainly that is true if you compare 1800 to today. Now, economists might say we're 500 times wealthier. But that's not true. We're like 1,000,000 times wealthier. It might be in things we can measure only 500 times wealthier. But in real quality of life, in real improvement, in quality of life, it's 1,000,000 times. It's 1,000,000 times. All right, so that was an interesting thing that Nordhaus observed and really valuable. The other thing is this whole CO2 thing, and he built this whole model about CO2, and he came up with this number that the optimal tax is $30 for each ton of carbon dioxide. And politicians have grabbed onto that, and activists have grabbed onto that, and they run with it. And a carbon tax like that would increase the price of gasoline by about 27 cents a gallon, right? Now, when you actually look at the model, and Nordhaus himself has actually looked at the model, he said, look, I don't know, 30 bucks for each ton of carbon dioxide, that seems a little high. It's hard to tell. It might be too low. It might be too high. We actually don't know. He said the actual optimal tax should be somewhere between $6 a ton and $93 a ton. $6 a ton and $93 a ton, 15 times bigger. Which means your economics sucks, Nordhaus. You might have got a Nobel Prize for economics, but this sucks. You can't predict anything. You give me that kind of variation between 6 to 93, it's meaningless. But that's, of course, what has to happen. The fundamental premise here is that a central planner can somehow define exactly what the tax should be. They can't. It's impossible. Central planning is a losing strategy. And that's true of climate change and carbon taxes and every other form of central planning. Now, another economist, a free market economist by the name of Robert Murphy, has calculated the present value of damages caused by carbon dioxide, assuming Nordhaus's assumptions about damage, and abatement costs at $22.6 trillion. Right? That's the present value today. Mr. Nordhaus' optimal carbon tax would have reduced damages but increased abatement costs, decreasing the impact of emissions to a total of $19.5 trillion. So in other words, this carbon tax would actually have very little impact on actual long-term economic growth, if you will. Meanwhile, right, the Nordhaus model shows that the cost of a policy to limit the temperature increase to only 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit would have been $37.03 trillion. That's a lot of money. That's in present value terms. $16.4 trillion more than the cost of doing nothing. So actually putting a policy in place that decreases carbon emissions so that the temperatures only rise by 2.7 instead of the 4.1 degrees that they're predicting, would actually cost the economy more than not doing anything. Not doing anything. So even if you accept the numbers of these stupid models, which I don't, they advise, from a purely economic perspective, to do nothing. No carbon tax. Let the world heat up. It's cheaper to deal with the consequences of the world heating up than to fight carbon emissions. This is your lesson of today. It's cheaper. One day in the future, when we're richer, more prosperous, have better technology, to deal with the consequences of a warming climate, if indeed it's warming, much cheaper than it is to put in place today the laws and regulations, the costs, in other words, that would keep temperatures rising only 2.7 degrees instead of 4.1. So the whole thing is nuts. Free markets work. By the time climate change becomes a problem, we'll be so rich, we'll deal with it. We'll have the technology to deal with it. All right, I've got some super chat questions here I'm going to take quickly. Milton Friedman said open immigration is not good if there is a welfare state. What do you think? Look, I've talked about this so many times. I somewhat disagree with Milton Friedman because I think he exaggerates the effects of the welfare state. But on the other hand, I've said I am in the current context of a welfare state. I am not for open immigration in the sense of anybody could just cross the border. I am for a more open immigration. That is anybody who can get a job and therefore will not be on welfare. Anybody who can get a work visa to come to the United States, not after the company proves that they can hire somebody better, prove that they can't hire an American. But just you can get a job, that you compete for American jobs from anywhere in the world. And if you can get a job, you get a visa. That's my solution to the problem of the welfare state. If you can get a job picking apples, a job that sustains you for the time you're going to be in the United States, you can get a visa. So you ban all welfare from immigrants, and you make them have to have a job before they enter the country. And you would have massive amounts of new legal immigrants. You would have a massive decline in illegal immigrants, probably close to zero, because illegal immigrants who want to come to the United States to work would still come, but now they would come legally, and they would be able to go back and forth to Mexico, wherever their families are, and they wouldn't be stuck in the United States without being able to go back, and the whole environment would change dramatically. Just make legal immigration really, really, really easy and based not on family relations, not on anything, except your ability to find a job. You got a job? Get a visa. 5 years, renewable after 5 years if you still have a job. If you don't have a job, you're out, right? We're not there to feed you if you don't have a job. So you get a visa as long as you have a job. If you stick around for 15 years, you're eligible for green card, and after that, you're eligible for citizenship. Or Don't even make the first generation eligible for citizenship. Only the kids eligible for citizenship. I'm fine with all of that. But make it job-based. Okay, Rory McPoland. Hey, from Belfast. I know Dr. Peacock has spoken kindly of von Mises, but is the Austrian school the only compatible economic school with objectivism, where the mathematical models can't quite cut it? Yes. I think the Austrian school is the only compatible economic school with objectivism. The Austrian school is not... not completely developed. And some of it, particularly in its modern formulations, are anti-objectivist in the sense that they advocate for philosophical ideas at the foundation of their economics, which are bad. But in the sense of economic theory, in a sense of economic consistency, Mises and the better modern Austrian economists are the most and maybe only consistent economic theory with the philosophical ideas of objectivism. Yes. All right. You know what? I think that does it. I'm tired. Oh, one last one, because I haven't bashed Trump enough today. This is for the insanity file, the craziness file. Now, and again, I assume this is real, but you'll call me if this is fake news. So at a roundtable discussion at Northeast Iowa Community College in Trump is giving a talk, I think doing a rally today or tomorrow or this week in Iowa. And one of the things the Trump administration is expected to allow is or kind of require is the expanded use of ethanol in gasoline. And the reason for this is simple. The tariffs that the Trump administration has imposed on Chinese goods have caused the Chinese to impose tariffs on the United States, which has caused great suffering for those patriotic farmers in Iowa who raise corn for ethanol. And together with the soybean farmers, who have also suffered dramatically from tariffs, they have been complaining to the administration about their tariff policies. And if you remember a while ago, The soybean farmers got a huge subsidy, direct subsidy from the Trump administration so that they could survive the tariffs. Well, now it turns out that the Trump administration is going to increase the amount of ethanol contained in gasoline, which makes it quite a bit less efficient, is my understanding. So they're going to increase the amount of ethanol so that ethanol farmers make more money, corn farmers and ethanol producers make more money to compensate for the fact that the tariffs are hurting the farmers to begin with. So if you didn't follow that, I don't know, right? So Donald Trump penalizes farmers by imposing tariffs on the Chinese who impose tariffs on the farmers. Well, they don't really impose tariffs on the farmers, and Trump doesn't impose tariffs on the Chinese. Trump imposes taxes on American consumers. The Chinese then impose taxes on their consumers, which reduced the demand for corn from soybeans from the United States. And the Trump administration has to now tax American citizens in order to pay a subsidy to corn farmers and soybean farmers so they don't go out of business because of the tariffs that the Trump administration initially put together. Now, that's called insanity. That's called evasion. That's called economic stupidity. We've got a Nobel Prize winner who's pathetic. We've got a Exxon with no backbone. We've got Venezuela that is nuts, and we've got a Trump administration that is insane. I mean, the world is going to hell. Right? Anyway, but we might as well have fun while it's going to hell. So, I don't know. You guys still support Trump in spite of that? I guess so. Why not? He's politically incorrect, and that trumps everything. Okay, I'm going to leave Elon Musk. Elon Musk says shorting should be illegal. We'll talk about that another time. All right, so let me end with a super chat question. Any thoughts on Nikki Haley's resignation? I mean, not many. I don't know what's going on there. Nikki Haley was impressive as UN ambassador. There should be no UN ambassador. The UN should be shuttered and shipped off to Venezuela. I've been saying that since before Venezuela was such a horrible place, but it was always the appropriate place for the UN to be. The United States should not be involved at all. It should not have ambassador. It should not be funding it. It should not be subsidizing it. But of course, I'm far more politically incorrect than the Trump administration is. And, you know, that's part of the problem. Part of the problem is Trump is way too mainstream in his policies. Maybe not in his language, but certainly in his policies. So, you know, Nikki Haley, I thought, was as good as a UN ambassador could be. I thought she made some excellent statements. She seems incredibly articulate. She seems strong. She functions well under pressure. I would hire her if she's looking for a job. I don't really have a job for her, but if I had a job, I would hire her. I think she's intelligent. I think she should run for president, and I'd take her over Donald Trump in a heartbeat and over Mike Pence in a heartbeat. I would vote for a woman president if it was Nikki Haley versus pretty much any Democrat. She doesn't strike me as particularly religious, even though she won. She was governor of South Carolina. She doesn't strike me as particularly collectivist or nutty. I can't remember. She's half Indian from India. She just strikes me as intelligent. I'd have to go back to her record in South Carolina to really evaluate her as a presidential candidate. I hope she runs. I don't think she'll run against Trump. I don't think anybody, except maybe, former governor of Ohio. I don't think anybody's going to run, Kasich. I don't think anybody will run against Trump. I think Trump will win the Republican nomination easily, and he might win the presidency again, for all I know. It's so hard to tell. We'll know more in the midterms. We'll know more after the midterms. I'm not predicting the midterms. We'll know more after, but 2024, but I'd certainly vote for her in 2020. I'd vote for her over Trump. Now, that's not saying much. I'd vote for almost anybody over Trump in the Republican Party, and many, many people in the Democratic Party, I would vote over Trump. But Nikki, I like Nikki. All right, that's it. I'm done. All right, so a few housekeeping things. You know, I'm doing this event in New York with Dave Rubin and Eric Weinstein. It's at 7 p.m. on Saturday at the New Yorker. I hope you guys come. I hope anybody who's in the New York area joins us. I think it'd be fascinating. Me and Eric Weinstein talking and Dave Rubin moderating. I mean, it will be up afterwards on YouTube, but hey, you get to be live. You get to see Dave Rubin live. You get to see Eric Weinstein live. And most importantly, you get to see me live. And if we can't fill a little place like the New Yorker, then, you know, I don't know, right? I mean, Jordan Peterson charges hundreds of dollars per seat, and he fills up auditoriums much bigger than that. So I'm really going to have a inferiority complex if you can't fill up the New Yorker auditorium in New York City this Saturday. So if you live in New York City, if you live in the New York City area, please come and join us. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I think you can really enjoy it, and it's going to be really good. I'm going to challenge Eric Weinstein on his understanding of economics, and I think it's going to be quite fiery and quite heated. So it should be good. Please subscribe, share the show. If you like the show, share it and subscribe. And of course, support me on Patreon. I've seen a little spike since yesterday, since I asked for your support. Thank you. Thank you for all of you who have been supporters for a long time. Roy a few minutes ago said that he was a supporter, and he is. And you know, thank you for that. And he's a first time supporter today. And a number of you, I think, added your support today. So thank you for doing that. There's still many, many, many of you who are not supporters of the show on Patreon. So please do so. Patreon.com/Iran Bookshow. And of course, drum roll, another drum roll for Jonathan Honing's latest project, which is, I don't know how I didn't mention it in the previous show. It's ridiculous. And I apologize profusely to Jonathan for him having to remind me of mentioning this, because Jonathan has published the unfinished manuscript of Ayn Rand's Textbook of Americanism, which she wrote in the 1940s, and she never finished. But what Jonathan did is he got other writers to complete the textbook. So there are essays there by my mind is blanking, Greg Salamiri and by Uncle Gatte, and by, I think, Don Watkins, and by Ilan Juno, and many, many, many other objectivist intellectuals, and by me, all kind of trying to, without being presumptuous, acknowledging that we don't know what Ayn Rand would have done if she wrote the textbook today. We don't know what she would have done if she had to deal with the issues we have today. But trying to imagine that, trying to complete the project and updating it to today, which is was my assignment in the in my essay, was what were the issues that she would be confronting today as opposed to what she was thinking in 1947. But a lot of it also has to do with her own thinking that evolved from the 1940s to the 1950s, 60s, 70s when she was writing. She was still early in explicitly developing a philosophy when she wrote Textbook of Americanism. And, you know, anyway, this book is fabulous. Fabulous. A new textbook of Americanism. And it really is amazing. And actually what I should do, and what we will schedule for soon, is I should do a show with Jonathan where we basically talk about the book. And we talk about the key theme of the book. Because Ayn Rand identified what is the, and I've said this many, many times, and this is why I say people like Donald Trump do not know what America is. You can't make America great again when you don't know what America is. And Ayn Rand identifies what America is. And she identifies Americanism with individualism. And Donald Trump is no individualist. And only when you do that can you understand that what does America represent? And then how do you make America great again? It's by making individualism great again. It's by now investing in a philosophy of individualism. So buy the book. I think it's now available in Kindle. So on electronic form, it's available, and you can get it on Amazon. So Textbook of Americanism, edited by Jonathan Honing. And I'm going to have Jonathan on the show to talk about the book and really pitch it hard, because you all should buy it. And more importantly, you all should read it, because it's so, so, so important. All right. Somebody says, don't forget they're individualist Marxist. Let me tell you something. There are no individualist Marxists. That is by definition a contradiction in a term. It either means you don't understand what individualism is, or you don't understand what Marxism is, or they don't understand what they are. But neither one. All right, buy the book. Buy a textbook, a new textbook of Americanism. And you can also go and find the website, textbookofamericanism.com. Textbookofamericanism.com. All right. Thanks, everybody. Have a great week. And actually, I was supposed to have a Yaron and Amy show today, and we didn't do it, but we'll do it tomorrow, probably. But it will be in an off hour. It will be in the middle of your work day. So tomorrow we will discover whether you actually work or actually listen to podcasts while working. So it's going to be during the work day. I'm not sure exactly on the time. I'm still working on it. But Europeans, it'll be while you're awake. So we'll get some Europeans watching us live. Talk to you all tomorrow. Have a great week. And I press stop streaming. Stop recording.